Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and it's all about compliance with the Constitution. We definitely want you to, in any way possible, to help and support Gerald or Jerry Wistrand. He's running his campaign in Missouri for the auditor's position. Hope you understand, and I kind of go over this, an auditor actually looks at contracts. They determine whether the contract's being fulfilled, whether there's any shenanigans, those types of things. And folks, your Constitution is a contract. Have you connected the dots on this yet? Your auditor can actually start saying, hey, hold on here. You're going to spend money in doing something that our contract that the people have given us in empowering us to do things doesn't include us doing that. Which means that most any and all new contracts that are outside the scope of your Constitution, the auditor and Jerry will shut it down. Do you understand this, folks? Now all of a sudden we have a statewide position that is going to start teaching people, look, you want us to do this, you have to amend the Constitution. Our authority comes from that document. It doesn't come from the whims and the desires of the state legislature or the governor. That is huge. And we're dying here. And folks, I hate to think that we can't get him any support. Please, please figure out what you can do. I've told people in past campaigns, and we've actually had some cooperation where people would set aside a little bit of their gas money or food money or something out of their discretionary fund to send a little bit of help each week or once a month or what have you. He needs your help. And he's going to get primaried out in August if we don't get him out and supported so that he can get the word out. And he's really the only challenger, the only challenger. It's not like there's a huge field of auditors running. This is a great opportunity. America has a great opportunity here. So let's please, carpe diem, seize the day, seize the moment, get some love and help to Jerry. Anyway, with that, actually, welcome back, Sean. I decided to share a little bit of wisdom, if you want to call that. I think you told me, but I don't remember. What was your MOS in the Army?
31 kilo.
Yeah, you may have given me the numbers, and I asked, oh, okay. What did that translate to?
It mostly wireman and radio.
Okay. So you actually
did all the cryptography at the time, which was pretty crude, but we handled all of that.
Cryptography, in other words, mapping? No, that's cartology. No. I'm sorry, cryptology. Right. Okay, so that is encoding and such.
Correct.
And so where did you go to
school? Did y'all use those code books where you have like the daily passwords for checkpoints and stuff like that? Yeah.
Yep, for ops and all that, yep. That all fell under ops. Yeah, and you guys are driven definitely by ops. But where did you go to school, your MOS school?
I went to Georgia, Fort Gordon.
Okay. And how tough was the school? I mean, did you have to take notes and all of that?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because, you know, it's just like a career. It's not like, you know, with school, see, the people don't understand. You go to an MOS school, you flunk out. Guess what? You get reprocessed, and next thing you know, you're going to Motor T, or you're going to become a cook.
Right.
And you flunk out of that. And I don't know what's worse. They just give you a less desirable job if you can't make it through your A school or through your occupational specialty school.
So
they send you to the engineers with an entrenching tool.
There you go, with your own personal trenching tool, and it's collapsible, so you can put it in your rucksack.
Yes, sir.
Back when they called it rucksacks, but anyway, folks, those of you who are reading along with us, you have the soft copies. We've got them up there, and hopefully you're downloading them. And as you can tell, I highlight these things. As we go through these, and there's definitely things that either I highlight and or let's say you want to make a more, you know, unique note on something else, what have you, because it, you know, it's clicking in your head more than it clicked in mine or what have you. For whatever purpose, there's no reason why you can't use the tools in Word, because these documents are in Word. When you download them, they're in Word. So there's no reason why you can't just grab real quick and start initiate a comment and put, you know, just literally write note here so that when you come back, you'll find all these little comments and go, okay, I need to write a note about, oh, I remember what this was and what I was thinking and why this is important. One of the things I remember going through, because I went through lots, I actually had 5 different occupational specialties. I went through, believe it or not, food service. I went through imagery interpretation. I went through some other intelligence, 2 other ones that weren't. One was terrain analysis, and another one was system administration, to learning to, you know, operate and maintain and secure systems and so forth. And anyway, so long story short, in my very first school, which I came in open contract, and they love it when you come in open contract, because that's what, you know, opened the doors for me to become a cook in the Marine Corps. And there's a lot of math in it. And it's, you know, people would think, oh, you know, how hard can be a cook be? But you have to be good with fractions and so forth, because that's what you're dealing with recipes and so forth. But anyway, the instructor was always, and this was kind of common in any Marine Corps school, you know, the instructor, when they would tell you something, if it was really important, they would just say, now don't write that down, because that'll never come up and bite you on the backside, you know, in a test or in real life. Don't write that down, which is a big hint, or, you know, the foot is dropping to say, you better write that down. So the whole point is that when you make notes of things, when you, you know, all of a sudden something clicks, that's a highlight, and those things stick with you more so than anything and everything that we're saying and what Sean is reading and so forth. When you do it and when you actually create that note, when you create that highlight, now it's clicked with you. Now, we've done a lot. We've done the lion's share, I guess, in most cases of what you need to know. But if you become an active participant in this, then, because the whole point is not to get you to do what I want you to do, is to get you to profoundly understand what these men and how they describe this government, how it's supposed to operate, what we need to do, and so forth. Because when you have that profound understanding from them, it removes me from the equation. And secondly, you now have the ability to teach others the exact same thing. And I will tell you, you do not want to be the single point failure. Because with, you know, there's a lot of people that really think being the single point failure is the way to go, because it's job security. Well, in this particular case, you're going to realize that you can't be in all 50 states and in every county in a given Saturday. That's 3,000 places that you can't be. So what we need is we need everybody to understand this, as it's to make this stuff has to become common knowledge. And I hope that makes sense, folks, because when it becomes common knowledge, then all of a sudden, when people are confronted with what do? Well, the first thing is, you know, everybody starts asking the fundamental questions. Do they have the authority to do this? No, they don't have the authority. Then it becomes really easy
They can't do it. The solution is so easy if they don't have the authority, which is why I always start this off with that debt is fraud, because they're creating debt without the authority to get that debt to spend the money that they're spending the money on those items, those objects that they have no authority to do. So with all that being said, I just wanted to impress upon you, because I think that it would do us all a big service if you took it upon yourself to become that champion, to become, you know, that leader in knowledge, in building a team of leaders in knowledge where you live. This is exactly what we need. We need people on the ground. Because if you think, oh, well, when the crap hits the fan, we'll just be able to connect in Zoom with GR and he'll help us out. I'm going to tell you, folks, those types of communications, those types of things will be taken. When they don't want us to get organized and they don't want us, it's not going to be easy. This is why the more we have local, I'll just say no local statesmen, because that's what we are. We need to be statesmen. We need to be the ambassadors of the Constitution. And that, in a way, that kind of puts, you know, there's all sorts of great titles, great names. You can call yourself the Sage of New Orleans, Sean. Sean, the Sage of New Orleans.
Not quite, sir.
But the point is that, and it's not really about trying to make us feel better. It's about actually being a part of the solution. We need statesmen, because statesmen is the ingredient necessary to help guide people and to help them understand what these things mean and what we need to do and so forth. So with that, let me just kind of leave that right there. Because you have the opportunity, folks. We're going through this with you. And this is all for hopefully not futile, hopefully for a good purpose, good cause. And that you can leverage these opportunities of reading with us, so that you can actually start reading. Because, you know, there's no reason why you can't duplicate what we're doing. We've identified the five critical documents. You can actually go read along, and we're trying to create documentation, because I know Sean has done it. He gave it to me. He's already given me the transcripts of what we've done, and, you know, who has just been too busy to even go back to that. But I have the transcripts, and if people were begging and knocking on the door, can you give us these things? It'd be the impetus, at least, to force me to find the time to do it. Because I hate to have people do something and spend time and energy, and it just sit there and languish. I will say this, I mean, having those things, and what I should probably do, even if I don't do anything else, is get those transcripts up so that they're at least available so that people can just parse through them. Parse through them on their own, because, you know, that way at least you can do something with them. And if you actually do something, then we'll share that. Because this is a group effort. This is not, a one-man job. I've said this. The president can't do this. We have to do this. We, the people, have to do this. So we're back in the debates, and we are going through the Massachusetts debates. And in this particular debate, we are going through the Congress is not immune line, or the Congress is not immune portion of the ratification debates. And I'm trying to find out who the heck said this. And so, do you got that? Who?
'Cause I can't. Baldwin.
Okay. Yes, Baldwin. Yes, Doan, something like that. So anyway, let's go ahead and bring that. I'm going to try to bring this forward. For some reason, it's all screwed up. Okay, I've got it now. All right, so go ahead and let's start off with the Congress is not immune.
In determining on this question, every gentleman will, doubtless, consider the importance of cultivating a spirit of union among ourselves and with the several states. This spirit procured our emancipation from British tyranny, in the same spirit, by uniting us in the necessary means, must secure to us our dear-bought, blood-purchased liberty and independence, and deliver us from evils which, unless remedied, must end in national ruin. The means for effecting these purposes are within our reach, and the adoption of the proposed Constitution will give us the possession of them. Like all other human productions, it may be imperfect, but most of the imperfections imputed to it are ideal and unfounded, and the rest are of such a nature that they cannot be certainly known but by the operations of the Constitution. And if, in its operation, it should in any respect be essentially bad, it will be amended in one of the modes prescribed by it. I say will be amended, because the Constitution is constructed on such principles that its bad effects, if any such should arise from it, will injure the members of Congress equally with their constituents, and therefore both of them must be equally induced to seek for and effectuate, if possible, the requisite amendments. There have been many objections offered against the Constitution, and of these the one most strongly urged has been the great power vested in Congress. On this subject, I beg leave to make a few general observations, which ought to be attended to as being applicable to every branch of that power. It may therefore be observed that the investiture of such power, so far from being an objection, is a most cogent reason for accepting the Constitution. The power of Congress, both in the legislative and executive line, is the power of the people, collected through a certain medium to a focal point, at all times ready to be exerted for the general benefit, according as circumstances or exigencies may require. If you diminish or annihilate it, you diminish or annihilate the means of your own safety and prosperity, which means, if they were to be measured like mathematical quantities, would be in exact proportion as the power is greater or less. But this is not the case, for power that does not reach or is inadequate to the object is worse than none. An exertion of such power would increase the evil it was intended to remove, and at the same time create a further evil, which might be a very great one, the expense of a fruitless exertion. If we consider the objects of the power, they are numerous and important, and as human foresight cannot extend to many of them, and all of them are in the womb of futurity, the quantum of the power cannot be estimated. Less than the whole, as relative to federal purposes may, through its insufficiency, occasion the dissolution of the Union and the subjugation or division of it among foreign powers. Their attention is drawn to the United States. Their emissaries are watching our conduct, particularly upon the present most important occasion, and if we should be so unhappy as to reject the federal Constitution proposed to us, and continue much longer our present weak, unenergetic federal government, their policy will probably induce them to plan a division or partition of the states among themselves and unite their forces to effect it.
Okay, so a couple of things to take away. First off, obviously, he talks about the immune, but before that, he makes this little point regarding the Constitution and the necessity of amending it. And he basically says it may be imperfect. I think we heard Madison and other framers refer to the Constitution as it's not perfect. And here he says it may be imperfect. But I don't believe these men knew in ways the things that made this Constitution imperfect were the compromises that they put into it so that they could maintain the Union. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. But at the same time, if I'm right about what you're talking about, it did serve to correct those imperfections.
Well, so in ways it put things in motion, yes, it did. But there were parts of, like, one of the things that was imperfect about it was the idea of placating the southern states by forcing other states to return runaway states to those states. That's in Article 4, I think Section 2 or something like that. But anyway, those types of things became challenged later on by the states to say, hey, you know, you may have created this dredged state of your own with, you know, maintaining slavery, but the fact that you're putting blood on our hands because we're now legally obligated to do this, you know, we have a conscientious objection against this, and we have a right to do so. And so that actually started creating I think it created more heat to the abolition movement. But all that being said, the Constitution, its failings, or I should say its flaws, were far more driven by the compromises than anything else. Because when you take those few things out of the Constitution, I have a hard time finding flaws in it. Some flaws that we see today, that I see today, is the fact that the Supreme Court or the federal court is not representative in kind. That today it has become a vestige of the Ivy Tower and socialism. And utilitarian or whatever the word is for that, form of ideology where they, you know, want society to be able to bend and shape towards what they feel is better. They created this living constitution. They assumed powers. There's a huge problem with the federal courts, and that needs to be amended. And one, it needs to be representative, and it needs to be tied down. And so, far more so than it is, because we can see how they have gotten on top of us and they've been controlling us just like the parties, just like the corporations and banks. But another flaw that I see in the Constitution is that states are forbidden to create another constitution or another compact with each other in dealing with domestic matters. We've gotten to a point of maturity as a union where we should have a highway system. Clearly, that was never delegated to the federal government. And clearly, it's not, nor was the federal government, or I should say the general government this general government that serves the states, it was never intended for them to be involved in domestic matters. Their focus was national security. Their focus was foreign trade, those external things that Madison talked about. So the ability for states to actually come together and create a highway commission, to create ways of cooperating with maybe law enforcement on their own instead of using the federal government, because the more power the federal government assumed, the more power they exerted, and the more that power became more maniacal and mischievous and outright nefarious. So I can see, as we've matured, we have grown into this Constitution to say now we're ready for even a better, and probably in the way most people would hear me talk about these congresses or these consortiums or what have you of transportation or infrastructure, maybe healthcare, those types of things where the states can actually cooperate with each other by creating a Congress or a delegation, a commission. That way, we're not using the federal government to basically inflict upon us. It allows us to steer which direction we want to go energy-wise. Do we really want the federal government to continue to bow to and creating these oligarchies of power throughout the globe? Because that's what they've been doing. They've been empowering oligarchies. And had we actually been controlling it at the state level, I don't think that ever would have happened. I don't think it ever would have happened. But that's only because we, as a society, have gone down the path of allowing the federal government to just continually do things for us because they give us money to go along with it. and they've completely weaponized all these things we've done. But anyway, when we come back, I'll wrap up the few points that he talks about in this one section of Congress Not Immune. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so anyway, I'd like to point out when these guys actually made these comments that they looked at this instrument, this Constitution, as something that, you know, wasn't necessarily perfect. And that because, you know, you can find flaw in almost anything, especially man-made. But the key point here, and this is really highlighted for this very specific reason, because Massachusetts was the only state that realized that Congress had no authority to pass a law that would allow them to be immune from it. When they passed a law that was applied to the Union, they were equally a part and would be equally oppressed by it, which is one of the reasons why, in talking about amendments, they would be equally interested in fixing the Constitution so that they, you know, they wouldn't be oppressed in the ways of, you know, creating a law or what have you, or why they would need to make these changes, what have you. So the point is right here where it says that if any should arise from it, will injure the members of Congress equally with their constituents. That right there basically states that when they created Social Security, they had to equally participate. When they, if they had the power to do it, they would have to equally participate. They'd actually have to put in the Constitution a clause that would say Congress is above their own, the consequences of their own laws. Now, there actually, you know, there is a line in the Constitution that gives Congress the authority to be able to violate the law. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Yeah. So, in other words, they can speed, they can violate traffic laws and those types of things.
Oh, they can't be arrested on their way to the...
While they're in session. Yep, right. There are certain things that give them immunity because they were viewed as that important. Judges don't have that. That clause isn't in there for the judges or the president. Only the legislators. And as a matter of fact, most states have that clause in for their state legislatures as well in their constitution. Yeah.
So you should probably ask Cynthia McKinney about that.
Who?
You've never heard of Cynthia McKinney?
Cynthia McKinney, no.
She was a congresswoman who was arrested in front of the state, the Capitol.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So was that a January 6th thing?
No. Oh. No, it was way before that.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yes. Yeah.
She's, what would you call it? She's one of the people who's in the tax reform movement.
Okay.
And that's how she ended up getting elected. She's still out there.
Oh, active, okay.
But I'm not sure. She was kind of one of the first victims of cancel culture before the internet started, you know, making a thing out of that.
Okay. All right. Well, okay. So I don't know if what she was doing... Was she a congresswoman at the time, or was she just a citizen?
No, she was a congresswoman.
Okay.
Yeah, so I don't know the circumstances. But, I mean, if it fell under where she should have been protected, then, yeah. Well, so here's another one. I mean, look at what happened in Texas when the Texas Democrats fleed jurisdiction. They fleed the state while they were supposed to be in session.
Right.
And, you know, that backfired on them. But unfortunately, you know, there's these, they always find these little loopholes that they think they can get away with, what have you. But anyway, let me get to this last one, because at the very end of this, what you read, it talks about the inefficiencies of, you know, this current Articles of Confederation that they're dealing with. And he basically says it's unenergetic. It doesn't have the ability to do anything. It, you know, it's just lipstick on a pig. And so you can tell he's a huge advocate for the ratification of the Constitution. And now a little bit further down, he talks about delegated power. So let's go into that.
Alrighty, sir. It will be and has been said, this great power may be abused and, instead of protecting, may be employed by Congress in oppressing their constituents. A possibility of abuse, as it may be affirmed, of all delegated power, whatever, is by itself no sufficient reason for withholding the delegation. If it were a sufficient one, no power could be delegated, nor could government of any sort subsist. The possibility, however, should make us careful that in all delegations of importance, like the one contained in the proposed Constitution, there should be such checks provided as would not frustrate the end and intention of delegating the power, but would, as far as it could safely be done, prevent the abuse of it. And such checks are provided in the Constitution. Some of them were mentioned the last evening by one of my worthy colleagues, but I shall here exhibit all of them in one view. The two capital departments of government, the legislative and executive, in which the delegated power resides, consisting of the President, Vice President, Senate, and Representatives, are directly and by their respective legislatures and delegates chosen by the people. Oath. The President and also the Vice President, when acting as President, before they enter on the execution of the office, shall each, quote, solemnly swear or affirm that he will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of his ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, end quote. Quote, the senators and representatives before mentioned and the members of the state legislatures and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution, end quote. Quote, the President and Vice President and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes or misdemeanors, end quote. Quote, no senator or representative shall, during the time for which he was elected, be appointed to any civil office which shall have been created or the emoluments whereof shall have been increased during such time. And no person holding any office under the United States shall be a member of either house during his continuance in office, end quote. Quote, no title of nobility shall be granted by the United States or by any particular state, and no person holding any office of profit or trust under the United States shall, without the consent of Congress, accept of any present emolument, office, or title of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state, end quote. Quote, the United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government, and shall protect each of them against invasion and domestic violence, end quote. To these great checks may be added several other very essential ones, as the negative which each house has upon the acts of the other, the disapproving power of the president, which subjects those acts to a revision by the two houses and to a final negative. Unless two-thirds of each house shall agree to pass the returned acts, notwithstanding the president's objections, the printing the journals of each house containing their joint and respective proceedings, and the publishing from time to time a regular statement and account of receipts and expenditures of all public money, none of which shall be drawn from the treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law. All these checks and precautions provided in the Constitution must, in a great measure, prevent an abuse of power, at least in all flagrant instances. Even if Congress should consist wholly of men who are guided by no other principle than their own interests, under the influence of such checks, this would compel them to a conduct which, in the general, would answer the intention of the Constitution. But the presumption is, and if the people duly attend to the objects of their choice, it would be realized that the President of the United States and the members of Congress would, for the most part, be men not only of ability, but of a good moral character, in which case an abuse of power is not to be apprehended, nor any error in the government, but such as every human institution is subject to.
And
shall I read that part again?
Yeah, so there's, it's surprising how well they kind of understood what was going on. What I really want to highlight is right up here under the delegated part, before the oaths part of what you read, that a possibility of abuse, as it may be affirmed, of all delegated powers, because the whole point was, and we've heard this argument, right? I said, we're going to hear this argument several times that, hey, these powers can be abused. And so, the quick refutation is, well, anything can be abused. But he kind of goes into the details here, and he says, a possibility of abuse, as it may be affirmed, of all delegated power, whatever by itself no sufficient reason for withholding the delegation. If it were a sufficient one, no power could be delegated, nor could government of any sort subsist. The possibility, however, should make us careful that in all delegation of importance, like the one contained in the proposed Constitution, there should be such checks provided as would not frustrate the end and intention of delegating the power, but would, as far as it could be safely done, prevent the abuse of it. And such checks are provided in the Constitution. But guess what? They're not in the state Constitution. See, this is the whole point. They understood then that this federal constitution was important. Why did we marginalize our state constitutions? Because, folks, look at how little power they have and what they're doing. And they're doing this like puppets for the federal government. It's almost like the federal government, the child, became the puppet master of this. What do you call the marionette, right? A marionette Correct. Show. And so it's just like, oh my gosh, they've got our good people down at the county level doing evil things to us, where it's like the blood's not on their hands, it's on these other people's hands. They're spreading the wealth. So this goes back to, how important is it that we really hold and get our states back into control, because our state constitutions are literally being trampled over? I mean, if the U.S. Constitution is dangling by a thread, then your state constitutions are just basically shattered and or just asundered. I mean, they're just fragmented as, gravel being trampled over by the masses, because everything is up for sale and everything is up for grabs at the state level. And this is all happening because the counties never understood the importance of taking ownership of our counties in keeping that state government in check. See, the whole point is, and we're going to find this out, that it is the state government's responsibility to keep this federal government in check. That when they start to drift a little bit, it's the states that's supposed to say, hey, you can't do that. But boy, it's really hard to not hear what somebody's saying when they're coming with something that's so shiny and so oh, so attractive, like gold and silver in their hands, and say, this could be yours. We just need you to do these things with this. And that's how it's done. The point is, this one part right here, yes, absolutely power, and the power is being abused in every level. This, I can't emphasize enough, folks, if you are not driving and demanding for constitutional compliance committees in your county and getting your county to wake up and create your own county constitution and get a majority of the counties in your state to create their own constitutions. Once you have a critical mass, over 50%, yeah, but I would like to see two-thirds. 66.6%. Or, you know, three-fourths, 75%. I'd like to see a significant majority of the counties come up and say, look, we have constitutions now, and now we want to put these in force, and the only way to do that is for us to create a new constitution that is going to be more representative of the people of this state throughout the entire state, in every county, not just the population center. And I think people will start waking up at that point, folks, and they'll start realizing that the way to amend your state constitution should require a significant number of counties to ratify it, not a popular vote. The fact that the crap that we accepted and the things that we injected into our state constitutions, it just makes me ashamed of how thoughtless these men were. I mean, okay, no, not everybody's a Madison. I get that. But really? Mob rule? Anyway, it just started getting done, and it got done in every state. If you go through why counties matter most, I think there's only two or three states that really don't have mob rule in changing their constitution, their state constitution. It's that few. It's sad. Anyway. Okay, so as we kind of plunder further and farther down here, he goes into delegated again. And so let's go into this right here.
With regard to rights, the whole Constitution is a declaration of rights, which primarily and principally respect the general government intended to be formed by it. The rights of particular states or private citizens not being the object or subject of the Constitution. They are only incidentally mentioned. In regard to the former, it would require a volume to describe them, as they extend to every subject of legislation not included in the powers vested in Congress. And in regard to the latter, as all governments are founded on the relinquishment of personal rights in a certain degree, there was a clear impropriety in being very particular about them. By such a particularity, the government might be embarrassed and prevented from doing what the private as well as the public and general good of the citizens and states might require. The public good, in which private is necessarily involved, might be hurt by too particular an enumeration, and the private good could suffer no injury from a deficient enumeration, because Congress could not injure the rights of private citizens without injuring their own, as they must, in their public as well as private character, participate equally with others in the consequences of their own acts. And by this most important circumstance, in connection with the checks above mentioned, the several states at large, and each citizen in particular, will be secured, as far as human wisdom can secure them, against the abuse of the delegated power.
So right here is where it is brought up again by the same man, that Congress cannot be immune to their own acts, to their own tyranny. But more importantly, there's this little sneaky part that's sitting here, because we've talked about this, and we, you know, and I know it's really hard for people to fathom, and I know that this was, you know, equally hard. Believe me, I don't go through this argument of government being sovereign. And what are, you know, how is it that they're sovereign? Right here, he basically lays it out. The rights of particular states or private citizens not being the object or subject of the Constitution, they are only incidentally mentioned. He's talking about the whole point of the Bill of Rights and so forth. In regard to the former, it would require a volume to describe them, what rights they would have. And they extend to every subject of legislation not included in the powers vested in Congress. And in regard to the latter, as all governments are founded on the relinquishment of the personal rights in a certain degree, there was a clear impropriety in being very particular about them, by such a particularity that government might be embarrassed and prevented from doing what the private, as well as the public and general good of the citizens and the states might require. He's dancing around this whole point of sovereignty. We give up to government powers. When we do that, we've relinquished our control over that. But we have a level of control because in a republican form of government, it is our representatives that are in control. So we still have this control, but the decisions are no longer made by us. We don't, you know, get a democratic mob rule vote to decide whether we go to war. It is now being handled by our representatives. But only that. They don't get to decide whether we're going to have a freeway system that is going to literally run diagonal across the United States from Maine to San Diego and from Seattle to Miami. They don't have that authority. If we give them that authority, then they can make those decisions. And yet, without the authority, they've been making the decisions. In other words, they've assumed sovereignty over anything and everything under the sun. They only have the sovereignty, as Madison states, government's authority comes from the constitutions. I can't emphasize enough. Again, whatever shade, when I say blue, whatever that shade is in your head when you think that there's that blue, that's my face. I'm blue in the face, repeating and repeating and repeating. Government's authority comes from the Constitution. Your state constitution is where your state gets its authority. Even your court is held to those few things that are listed in that state constitution. And the state court, if they were honorable men, would basically say, hey, look, you're bringing something here because the state government is doing something they have no authority to do. Instead of dancing around and running interference for them and saying, yeah, they can do this because we said it so. And it shall be written and it shall be done. So, and then again, at the very last part, again, he brings up this whole point of this lack of immunity, that there's nowhere in the Constitution that gives these congressmen any privileges whatsoever to be immune from what they're doing. So, you know, what do you think so far out of Massachusetts? We're starting to get into the really good stuff, because it's really going to get a little bit more spiritual, I think. More spiritual than any other. But so what do you think so far going through Massachusetts?
I think it very much defines the point that you're making about where the terms of the contract are laid out and what was intended and what's being misinterpreted. And I think it goes back to what you were saying in the early part of the show about people actually reading and getting this knowledge and information. And if not just as a statesman, but to reverse this paradigm of what the government was intended to do. It wasn't intended to make your life better, as the quote goes today. It was intended for specific delegated powers for the purposes intended.
Right.
Yes. I had a question about the highway system.
Yeah.
When you look at the Constitution, do they not have the authority to create post roads, and wouldn't the highway system be a?
So what's the word that they use
for that purpose?
Okay, yeah. So look it up. pull up your color-coded constitution.
I have it.
And that's what so there's, it, there's a specific word that they're using, though. Are they creating?
Yeah, crossroads.
No. There's a word, the adjective of what they're doing. Are they creating post-roads?
To establish post offices and post-roads. Roads.
Okay, so in other words, they're going to tell the state and the county where a post office is going to be and the road that they're going to use.
Correct.
That doesn't mean that they're building and creating.
So how are they establishing post offices?
So the post office is established, and they actually have the power in the Constitution for needful buildings, don't they?
Correct.
So they can actually spend the money in building a needful building, i.e. a post office, a shack, and actually in most cases, of America, the post offices were established by, you know, cordoning off a little part of a general store, like a 6x6, you know, corner, and that became the post office in the general store.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and they paid, you know, whoever owned that store rent or what have you for that little parcel, that little piece of land until they built their own. But for the most part, they have the authority for needful buildings so that they could do that. But they don't have the authority to buy up the land and to create these, what we would, because every road would all of a sudden become a post road. And that would make does that make sense?
Yeah. Actually it does. Yeah.
So, and that's when you actually read Monroe's veto statement of the Cumberland Gap bill. And this is all a part of the three presidential vetoes of the Department of Transportation. He points out that that power does not exist within the establishment of making post roads or of establishing post roads. That power doesn't exist.
Yeah, we went over that, didn't we?
What's that?
We went over that letter, I believe.
So actually, we have not gone over that. We ran out of time last year, and I hope that we get to it this year. Hope to, yes.
But maybe it was on a call or something.
It may have been, but I have a video of it, a 7.5-minute video that kind of just encapsulates it, and it's far better than, you know, what I could do in just reading the documents and then get everybody to just read, because we cite it and so forth. But anyway.
Right. Yeah, right. I got you.
Now,
I know I remember going through it and talking about that.
Now, Dr. Taylor has a complaint. And so there's this little short complaint. I don't want to miss it, but we're really out of time. So we will pick up with the complaint in our next episode. So, folks, unfortunately, we're out of time. But we're getting to the point where things are really going to come to a head. And this is when I think John Hancock recognizes, I think I've told you this already, he recognizes that this Constitution may actually be rejected in Massachusetts. And so he, you know, puts his finger, you know, licks his finger, you know, puts it in his mouth and puts it up in the air and goes, up, the wind is going the wrong way. And he does something that a president of a convention should never do, and he begs pardon of the committee or the delegates and so forth. We will be back in that. In our next episode, I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.